I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. Today's guests are Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware, co-authors of the recently published God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. Dr. Hoffman is a professor at Georgetown University, professor emeritus of terrorism studies at the University of St. Andrews, fellow at the U.S. Military's Academy's Combating Terrorism Center, and a fellow for counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations. Dr. Ware is a research fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and an adjunct professor at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service and at DeSales University. He serves on the editorial boards of the Academic Journal Studies in Conflict and Terrorism and the Irregular Warfare Initiative at the Modern War Institute at West Point. So Bruce and Jacob, welcome to Delving In.
Thanks very much for having us, Stuart.
Thank you.
So first off, congratulations about the publication of God, Guns, and Sedition, which provides a painstaking compendium and detailed description of far-right white supremacist terrorist attacks, not only in the U.S., but abroad as well. Before we dive in, tell us about the writing process, given that two of you are co-authors of the book. And along with this, give us an idea of the background that each of you brought to it.
I guess I'll start because I brought a very long background to the book and then enlisted Jacob to write it with me. Although Jacob had already written on Adam Waffen, a very important, violent, far-right terrorist group. So it was an excellent combination. We both shared this interest. But when I began my career as an analyst 43 years ago at the RAND Corporation, following violent far-right extremism was my account, as it were. In other words, everybody back then had a specialty and had to choose a terrorism group to focus on in addition to our other work. RAND Corporation, of course, being an independent, nonpartisan think tank that does work for the U.S. government and also for other clients. Basically, everybody else in the security and subnational conflict research unit that I had joined had chosen all the more popular groups of that era. The Red Army faction, also known as the Bader-Meinhof Gang in West Germany, the Red Brigades in Italy, the Provisional Irish Republican Army in Northern Ireland, or the Basque Separatist Group ETA in Spain, or the Weather Underground, and so on. So I chose what was remaining. And in the summer of 1980, a year before I started work at RAND, there had been three significant attacks by far-right terrorists at the Bologna rail station in Italy in the midst of the August holiday. And Bologna was a very working class and socialist and leftist or communist town. At the Munich Oktoberfest that September, and then at a Jewish synagogue in France. And many people thought that this was the beginning of a wave of far-right terrorism in Western Europe. Now, that didn't materialize. But within a very short space and time, I realized that many of the same trends were in fact unfolding in the United States, and that the traditional hate groups that were predicated on intolerance, racism, anti-Semitism, xenophobia, persecution of the Latino community, and so on, were still doing all those things, but now we're developing a salient anti-government component. So I researched this subject all during the 1980s and through Oklahoma City, had several publications on this movement. But then after September 11th, 2001, like every terrorism expert, my attention was wrenched elsewhere into the threat from Al-Qaeda and then subsequently ISIS. However, in February and March 2020, there were two developments. Firstly, as I recount in the book, I was the target of a serious hate crime that regenerated my interest in this. And also within weeks of that was the COVID lockdown. And both Jacob and I observed that across the internet and social media, the oldest anti-Semitic tropes were being resurrected to blame Jewish people for the for causing the pandemic so that a vaccine could be invented in Israel to cure it. We then saw this move on to targeting of Asians and Asian Americans with very short order. This is literally within days of the lockdown, and minorities. And we both thought that this was an unfolding trend that was going to have far-reaching consequences. Of course, this was nearly a year and a half, not quite, maybe 15 or 16 months before the seminal events of January 6th, 2021, which we couldn't have anticipated. But of course, we're in the middle of writing the book just when those happened. And that lent the book not only greater relevance, but also greater urgency.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk more about that toward the end of the interview, for sure. And how about you, Jacob?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. Based here in DC, when you walk through the halls of any national security agency in DC or think tank in DC, you'll come across all kinds of people who tell the same story about their interest in the topic. They all say, I had a plan for my life. I was diverted by 9/11, and I felt I had to serve my country through government or through research. That's not the case for me. I'm young enough that I don't really remember a life before 9/11. So it's a defining moment in my life, but not necessarily a pivotal one. The pivotal one in my life happened on July 22nd, 2011, when a white supremacist neo-Nazi opened fire at the youth summer camp for the Norwegian Labour Party, murdering 69 people at that location, mostly children. Being somebody who identified with the victims, being young, with grand ideological dreams for the world, that left a real mark on me. And I was always interested from that moment forth in far-right terrorism, and specifically white supremacist terrorism in all its different manifestations. So I studied that through college, really, undergraduate and graduate school at Georgetown, and then was offered the great opportunity to work with Bruce Hoffman, who's a legendary figure in terrorism studies. And as he noted, this book project started soon after that. And 4 years later, here we are with this product.
All right, so I'd like to clarify with you about the scope of the subject matter in the book. We're not talking about mass murders in the U.S. in general, many of which have been perpetrated in schools, often in acts of vengeful nihilism, not necessarily as an expression of white supremacy. So as awful as and increasingly frequent as the school shootings have been, they don't constitute a threat to our democratic system the way white supremacy does. So what exactly makes white supremacy such a danger as opposed to being some kind of fringe phenomenon?
I would say it's certainly one of numbers. I mean, this is the problem. Going back to the beginning of the 20-teens, we've had a series of politically motivated mass shootings. And of course, it's the political motivation that makes something terrorism, as opposed to the tragedies that unfortunately unfold with a depressing regularity across the United States at schools and places of worship and elsewhere. But starting with an attack in 2012, just in the past decade or so, on a Sikh temple following on the attacks at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, attack on a Jewish synagogue in Pittsburgh, attacks at a Jewish synagogue outside of San Diego in Poway, California, at a Walmart in El Paso, the Tops grocery outside of Buffalo. We've seen a whole series of often very highly consequential mass shootings perpetrated with a political motivation, often championing what might be called the great replacement theory that whites are being supplanted by immigrants. And then you have the entire militia phenomena in the United States, where various non-governmental organizations estimate that there are certainly hundreds of militias in every state of the Union. The New York Times about 3 years ago estimated that there were some 15 to 20,000 armed members of these militias prepared to engage in violence against the federal government. A colleague of ours in Washington, D.C., Cynthia Miller Idris, in her book, Hate in the Homeland, says that there's a total of about 75,000 armed militant extremists, among them the Boogaloo Boys, for example, a very loosely organized group of seditiously minded individuals who wear, for instance, Hawaiian shirts and combat webbing and have automatic weapons. So we're talking about, earlier on I mentioned, for instance, the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. They have never had more, literally, than three dozen trigger pullers or bomb throwers. Even the Provisional Irish Republican Army, which terrorized Northern Ireland and even England and the border area with the Republic of Ireland in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, never had more than 400 hardcore weapons-carrying or bomb-making individuals. So when we start talking about thousands, we're talking about a very different phenomena. And I think what makes this so challenging, too, is that many of these people consider themselves the ultimate patriots, or true patriots, or see themselves as doing something that's positive and altruistic, but also prepared to use violence against the federal government. And then let me lastly say, this is a phenomena that's been tracked in nationwide surveys the past 3 years or more, actually more than the past 3 years, by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland. What they found in the past 3 years, they've been tracking this for 2 decades, is what they found consistently for the past 3 years, is roughly a third of Americans believe that in certain circumstances, it's justified to use violence against the federal government. Roughly, let's say 36 or 38% or so of persons who identify themselves as Republicans, roughly 18 to 20% of persons who identify themselves as Democrats. But this is astonishing to my mind, that in a democracy like the United States, you have, let's say, if it's as little as a fifth and as much as a third of people that believe it's justified to use violence against the federal government, we're in a very dangerous situation.
And it sounds like you're saying that most of those people are on this, are sympathetic to the far right. Is that right? As opposed to the far left?
Yes. The numbers I've quoted are violent far right extremists. Jacob and I don't deny at all that there aren't violent far left extremists in the United States as well. And when you think about it, one of the most serious terrorist incidents of the past 6 or 7 years occurred in June 2017 when a self-professed supporter of Senator Bernie Sanders, but completely acting on his own, turned up at a baseball practice of Republican members of Congress in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., and seriously wounded 5 of the persons there, including the then Majority Whip, Louisiana Representative and Republican Steve Scalise. In fact, if Representative Scalise hadn't been there, and because he was Majority Whip, he had a plainclothes Washington Capitol Police personal protection detail with them. They engaged the shooter and prevented a greater tragedy. Then you also had, in July 2019, a self-proclaimed anarchist, someone actually in his 60s, which is an age we don't usually find someone engaged in this kind of violence, but nonetheless attempted to detonate a car bomb outside of an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Tacoma, Washington. And then there was the plot to attempt to assassinate Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. So we're not at all saying that there isn't a threat from violent left extremists, or even there are also violent far left militias now forming. There used to be a handful of them, 3 or 4 years ago. I would say there's at least 3 times that number, if not more. But we're talking about low double figures compared to hundreds when we talk about actual militia groups, and probably membership in the scores or maybe in the low hundreds compared to the tens of thousands, and as Professor Miller Idris estimates, perhaps as many as 75,000. So it's a matter of scale, not one or the other.
So one of the central points of your book, which lays out example after example, is that white supremacist violence has been with us for a long time, getting its first impetus in the anti-Black racism in the South after the Civil War, as embodied by the founding and subsequent revivals of the KKK. So what has it morphed into in the ensuing decades? And this is a big question. And when and how did it become a movement to overthrow the U.S. government?
I do more of the historical side. That's why I'm dominating.
Okay. All right. We'll hear from Jacob in a bit then.
Which makes sense, his familiarity with tech and social media. And also, this was what I was studying 40 years ago very intently. This is what drew us to this subject as well, is that we thought there were a lot of parallels between the situation in 2020 and in 1980, for example. In both eras, the United States was just coming off of decades-long overseas military commitments that had proven extraordinarily controversial. And for many of the persons who fought in those movements, they were highly dissatisfied that they hadn't proven more successful. So Indochina and Vietnam on the one hand, and then the wars on terror, particularly in Afghanistan.
And also another big factor is that a lot of the most dangerous members of these militias have military experience and training.
Yes. Yes. And let me also point out, too, that we've been told by federal authorities and law enforcement that both extremes attempt to recruit veterans. It's not that the violent far right has a monopoly on this. It's just that they tend to historically have attracted more, but both sides seek out veterans for prestige, but also for their skill sets, not just in the combat arms, but also in communications and logistics and organization. So there were the two parallels between multi-decade long overseas commitments ending with some dissatisfaction. I think fascinatingly in 1980 as well as 2020, there were profound economic concerns. Back in 1979, 1980, the inflation rate was in the high double digits. There was widespread fear in 2020 that the pandemic, the COVID pandemic and the lockdown would crater the U.S. economy. And then I think fascinatingly, in both eras, there was this profound preoccupation with immigration, both legal and illegal, that was becoming a flashpoint politically. And with those parallels in mind, that's why we set out to write the book. It was also because the movement was fundamentally changing in the 1980s. Prior to that, you had people parading in white sheets and white conical hats or wearing brown shirts with Sam Brown belts and Jodhpurs and Nazi regalia. But now you had a movement that still had the same elements of hatred and intolerance, but was broadening and expanding to include people that were militantly opposed to paying taxes, for example. People who believed in no legally constituted authority above the county level. So in other words, the elected county sheriff was the only official who they had to pay any attention.
You mentioned in the early 80s, do you lay any of the responsibility for this on Ronald Reagan, who famously said that the most frightening thing that you can ever hear is that I'm here from the government and I'm here to help?
I think less President Reagan than the shift from a very liberal president, Jimmy Carter, true, as you described, a genuine hardcore conservative that believed in small government like Ronald Reagan. But then on the part of these extremists, a failure of even someone that remotely ideologically aligned with them not to implement the far-reaching changes they sought. And that was another parallel with 2020, is that a very liberal president or relatively liberal president, Barack Obama, is followed by a much more conservative one, Donald Trump, who doesn't go far enough for many of these people. That's why they embrace violence as well. So there's very much that parallel. But I think it's the anti-government extremism that really emerges in the 1980s and sets it apart from previous hate and intolerance groups and the anti-government extremism that we saw around the late 20-teens and certainly in 2020, and that, of course, materialized on January 6, 2021.
If white supremacists have their own Bible, it would be William Luther Pierce's novel, The Turner Diaries, written under the pseudonym Andrew MacDonald. And I have to confess this, I hadn't heard of this. This has not been on my reading list. but tell us about this novel and how it came to wield such a powerful influence, the 200 to 500,000 copies sold.
In fact, a lot of scholars and journalists have repeated that the FBI claimed that the Turner Diaries is the Bible of the far right. And it turns out we couldn't find any evidence for that. The FBI has said it's a key foundational document. But what we surmise is that Pierce himself actually adopted that bumper sticker as a way to sell more books. And as you just pointed out, Stuart, he succeeded. Selling somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 books is an author's dream. And that was Pierce's genius. Firstly, he wrote the book under a pseudonym, Andrew MacDonald. But secondly, he wrote the book with a very specific purpose. He was also the head of an important American Nazi Party manifestation, the National Alliance. Pierce was not a stupid man by any stretch of the imagination. He actually had all of his undergraduate and graduate degrees, including his PhD in physics. He attended, for instance, Rice University, California Institute of Technology, two very fine universities, graduated from the University of Oregon, another excellent university, taught there for many decades. So he was not a stupid man. And as proof of his intelligence, he understood that endless regurgitations or recycling of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf or of Der Stürmer or of other Nazi-era propaganda would have a very limited audience in the United States. So in the late 1970s, he hit upon an idea to write a dystopian novel that would communicate exactly the racism, anti-Semitism, intolerance, hostility towards the U.S. government that his propaganda was also communicating, but didn't have quite the same resonance, but he hoped would prove extraordinarily popular because he wrote it as an adventure story of sorts. It's pretty grim reading, but he was right.
Yeah, would one of you give us a little plot summary of the Turner Diaries?
Well, it's basically about how people who style themselves as true American patriots become completely fed up with the country that they believe in. This is a quote from the book, becoming a mongrelized cesspool because of persons of color, because of Jews, because of immigrants, because of persons who are not white Anglo-Saxon Christians coming to the United States and stealing the birthright of white Anglo-Saxon Christians. And a fictional group calling itself the Order emerges to set a series of brush fires, in other words, acts of isolated, geographically dispersed acts of violence that eventually come together in this gigantic conflagration that overthrows the United States government. One of the climaxes of the book is when a truck bomb is placed in an underground garage of the FBI's headquarters, the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., and blows it up. That was exactly the blueprint that Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City on April 19th, 1995, in which 168 persons perished. Now, the Murrah Building did not have an underground parking garage, but in his surveillance of the building, McVeigh realized he could position the van right next to the building. In fact, there was an indented loading area so he could get this rider truck that he rented within 11 feet from the building, and it took it down. And when McVeigh was arrested about an hour later by a very alert Oklahoma State trooper, in a folder to his right on the passenger seat was a bunch of papers, including pages from the Turner Diaries that he had excised, that he had cut out and highlighted and underlined. And we know that McVeigh read the book many times. And also, when he was a soldier stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, used to earn pocket money by selling the Turner Diaries at local gun shows. So he was completely caught up in the message of the Turner Diaries. And repeatedly, in the research that Jacob and I do, especially in contemporary research, the Turner Diaries and its other climactic point, the so-called Day of the Rope. In the Turner Diaries, the Day of the Rope is when liberals and progressives, basically from Hollywood, in Los Angeles, are paraded in front of a scaffold and then publicly hanged. And of course, one of the enduring images of January 6, 2021, and the image on our book is of a scaffold and a hangman's noose in front of the United States Capitol, where there were persons that were prepared to hang, not Democrats or necessarily progressives, but a sitting Republican vice president who happened to be a Christian evangelical individual as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how a work of fiction could be such an inspiration. But on the other hand, the whole ideology of the white supremacist movement is basically a glorified fiction. It doesn't correspond to reality all that well. And so why shouldn't it be promoted and inspired by a work of blatant fiction? The other big influence is the 1915 silent film, The Birth of a Nation, which I understand was watched even in the White House. It was a very popular film. And yet it's also promoted these incredibly racist ideas.
Yes, Birth of a Nation, at least in film history, is an iconic touchstone. It was the most expensive film ever made to date. The sort of narrative arc of this very lengthy and long film has shaped Hollywood for decades afterwards. And in fact, the director, producer, and writer, D.W. Griffith, is the person who invented Hollywood. He was the first one to actually film in this fabled part of Los Angeles. He was the son of a Confederate Army officer. He was from Kentucky himself, so was very much steeped in the mythology and the romanticism of the Lost Cause. And of course, using a trope that we see today mentioned often, especially against immigrants, that they're raping white women. That was one of the key themes or plot lines of the film that recently freed slaves were now preying upon the purity of white womanhood in the South. And the film opened in 1915, coincidentally, exactly when the Ku Klux Klan was being revived. The Ku Klux Klan had been suppressed during the 1870s by President Ulysses Grant. In fact, the United States Justice Department was specifically created to enforce what were known as the Ku Klux Klan Acts, three pieces of legislation passed by the U.S. Congress during Reconstruction to outlaw the Klan. And it was outlawed, but then when the Klan revived itself, coincidentally around the time of Birth of a Nation, in other words, to broaden its aperture to attract an even more diverse constituency, it expanded from racism and a focus on re-enslaving African Americans through Jim Crow laws to hatred of Jews, especially Jews from Eastern Europe, hatred of Catholics, particularly Catholics from Southern Europe and Italy, and also Asians. And the Klan was very successful in the 1920s in lobbying Congress to enact the 1924 Immigration Act, which remained in force until 1965, and severely limited Jewish, Italian, and Asian immigration to the United States.
So I'd like to invite Jacob to join in the conversation here. Tell us about accelerationism. What is that and how does it apply here?
Accelerationism is a strategy of violent resistance or terrorism that seeks to advance or inspire acts of violence that will accelerate some kind of catastrophic, cataclysmic collapse or apocalypse or revolution, so that the current order, which they would argue is so corrupt and so broken that it must be destroyed, can then be replaced by a new world order more in line with what the extremists would desire. Now, in the cases that Bruce and I study, that's, of course, some kind of white supremacist ethnostate in the United States, whether that is covering the entire nation or covering some smaller area of the country. The kind of classic example of this is a race war. So an accelerationist would seek to inspire a racial war that would allow white Americans to defeat their minority enemies. And we trace that lineage in the book from the Turner Diaries, which, as Bruce explained, involves a race war, through to individuals like Dylann Roof, who, as he walked through the Mother Emanuel Church, was calling for a race war and viewed his attack as first salvo, hoping that, of course, Black Americans would respond in kind and then set off this chain of events leading to some epic conflagration and confrontation between what he viewed as the forces of good and the forces of evil.
They have a sincere belief that they can actually make this stuff happen. That's the thing that's so mind-boggling. It seems like sheer fantasy, and yet when you have numbers like this, maybe 100,000 people who believe this kind of thing and are trying to make it happen and think that they can, and I guess part of you, what you're saying is that if a heinous enough act occurs, then it could ignite a fuse and lead to more and more violent and explosive and damaging effects.
That's the goal, right? And I think one of the correctives that Bruce and I try to issue in our book and in our other writing is this concept was not invented by the modern far right. Al-Qaeda had that strategy on 9/11. Try to commit or create a major act of violence that's going to provocatively lead to a reaction from the government, and then you will inspire the masses to arise and reject that reaction. Same on October 7th. Terrorists see themselves as vanguards for their movement, and they believe that they will be the group that proves that political solutions don't work. You have to turn to violence. And they really do believe that others will follow in their footsteps once they see how the government reacts. Fortunately, of course, we have not seen either overwhelming reactions from the US government against this movement in ways that would provoke further violence. And we also haven't seen the masses rise up on behalf of these ideologies either.
So talking more about mindset, I think it's very clear from your book that we're not talking about purely a psychological phenomenon. It's a sociological phenomenon. It's a movement and it's a belief system. And yet there's also a psychological component in terms of who gets recruited, who's vulnerable to recruitment. And as a retired psychologist, I'm very aware that it's important to not engage in psychological reductionism. It's not just psychology, but psychology is a factor here in terms of who becomes a member of these groups and who's willing to perpetrate the worst of the crimes.
I'd be curious for your thoughts actually on our findings. So I think one of the more painful findings that we identify in the book is, especially over the past kind of 10 to 15 years, we have seen what you might call personal vulnerabilities rise to play a major role in the movement. Major role. Those include things like youth, mental illness, histories of bullying, loneliness, or isolation, histories of violence in the home, histories of parental or partner suicide, substance abuse, each of which lead to what you might call a typology of vulnerability that extremist groups and extremist ideologies can then prey on. One example of this can be seen in the Atomwaffen Division, which Bruce mentioned earlier, which was a major neo-Nazi group active in the United States around the middle of the last decade. When you look at the leadership of that group, as well as their murderers, all three of the killers related to the group and its founder all had autism spectrum disorder and at least one other mental illness. So this is a prominent neo-Nazi organization in the United States where mental health issues are playing a driving role. Now, what we don't know, and frankly is the million-dollar question in our field, it's honestly the reason our field exists, is what makes somebody go from being vulnerable to extremism to a violent mobilization? Because frankly, the typical finish to a radicalization process, like the typical way that a radicalization process ends, is actually not in violence. And we don't have the answers. There's scholars working on this, but we don't have the answers for why people take that final step towards violence and why most of them don't. And we don't get any close to that, to an answer to that in our book. But I think what we do show is you're right. There's the social aspect, there's the psychological aspect. And we see both of those interplay in quite interesting ways, especially over the past 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a tipping point phenomenon, and it's hard to predict exactly what's going to push somebody over the edge. It seems that it's multiple factors, as well as a lot of luck, who a person associates with.
I was just going to say that this is the holy grail of terrorism studies. Why does someone cross the line from extremism to violence? And of course, extremism is constitutionally protected in the United States under the First Amendment. It's only when you become a violent extremist, which is to say a terrorist, that you're breaking the law. But I think that I've spent nearly five decades now studying terrorism since I first went to graduate school in 1970. My conclusion is just as you described, Stuart. It's so highly idiosyncratic and so situational, opportunistic, psychological. It's just impossible to say. I think one of the core convictions that Jacob and I have, and one of the main arguments of the books, which I don't think will surprise you or any of your listeners, is that social media has played an enormously important role in sonically powering this forward and having a reach that draws people through the algorithms of the tech companies, through the messages, through the gaming platforms as well, where reality and fiction become so mixed together because the reality in many games is it's just within reach because it looks so real as well. All those things play a major factor, but at a particularly critical political moment, they come together to cause a storm such as we saw on January 6, 2021, that we could have never anticipated in any other era in the United States. And certainly Jacob and I, in the weeks leading up to January 6, just on open channels, not on the dark web or even encrypted types of emails, people were talking about converging on Washington, D.C., answering President Trump's call and threatening violence. This was being voiced quite openly.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned social media. That would have been the next thing I would bring up. And I can think of four different ways that social media accelerates this kind of thing. And one, of course, is recruitment, the ease of recruitment over the internet, the ease of coordination. But of course, along with coordination, there's also trackability. So there's an element on the containment side, and then exposure and notoriety, that you can become an instant celebrity. So just so many different factors. And frankly, we're not doing a very good job of clamping down on this stuff because of First Amendment concerns. And it's we're seeing it played out right now, I think, in the Supreme Court with that case about whether the government can even advise social media platforms to take down misinformation and disinformation. So it's a very live issue.
All of those factors you mentioned come together, we argue, to basically lower the barriers to entry to extremism. So some of the incidents that we've seen over the past 5 to 10 years are really rudimentary. both in the kind of age and ideological development of the individuals who conduct the attacks, and in the tactics, training, targeting, and therefore ultimate success of their attack, leading to this much more, I think, chaotic landscape where basically anybody has the means and can access the ideology required to become a terrorist. And that is quite an interesting, novel, modern development. Social media is totally the front line of modern extremism and terrorism. And social media companies have totally failed in their duties to participate in that battle. And to be frank, in our book, Bruce and I take a relatively hard line on that. We call for the reform of Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, which basically protects social media companies from being held liable for content on their platforms. It says social media companies are not publishers, and so they don't have personal responsibility for that content. That means that they can evade things like content moderation. It means they can evade things like algorithm reform. We saw two Supreme Court cases, I think, last year that were not seen through, that were not accepted, where individuals, family members of victims of terrorism, tried to sue the two platforms saying that they had been responsible in the radicalization processes of the terrorists. And it was struck down, largely, I think, because the Supreme Court just didn't want to be the body that made that decision. But we have noticed bipartisan support on cracking down on social media companies. So I think there is actually a realistic possibility that this one of our recommendations is seen through.
So, Jacob, maybe you could become an ambassador, being from the UK. In the UK and in Europe in general is, you know, much more capable and stringent about these things than the US. The US is going to lag behind and hopefully see Europe as an example of what to do.
The First Amendment is really the difference, right? The First Amendment has been used by social media companies to hide from responsibility, right? They say, listen, we don't want to be the body, we don't want to be the arbiter of free speech. We don't want to be the forum that has to have that conversation. European countries in the United Kingdom don't have to face that overtly. So they have more opportunity to crack down. And the European Union especially has really started to take this issue a lot more seriously and address it in a much more uncompromising way. And in Britain, we write in our book about something called the Online Harms Safety Act, the Online Harms White Paper, because actually the act came out after we finish the book. But we do see that the United Kingdom has taken far more stringent steps in ways that are quite innovative. And we would call for the United States to do the same.
So I'd like to take this last third of the interview and talk about Donald Trump, which I'm not always that eager to talk about him, but he's unavoidable for this topic. What special dangers does a possible re-election of Trump pose regarding white nationalism? Does he actually share their aims, or is he merely making use of the movement's ability to intimidate his enemies, which include politicians, judges, and journalists, among others? He's repeatedly encouraged, it seems, through coded language and a refusal to condemn white supremacy. And either way, the movement has been emboldened, and the country's likely to move in a more fascistic direction. Is January 6th a portent of things to come if Trump is elected again? And I realize this is a kind of a very fraught area, and it's necessarily somewhat speculative, but I can't avoid asking these questions.
For someone who's now studied this particular phenomena specifically for over four decades, one of the biggest differences between now and then is back in the 1980s, and you asked a question earlier about President Reagan, but any other elected officials, mainstream officials, would never have given top cover to this movement, would never have adopted any of its messages, any of its themes, any of its ideas, and then at least publicly articulated them. And this is a problem that we have seen with increasing regularity in recent years, and not just from former President Trump, but for others that have made statements that reflect some of the beliefs of this movement, including great replacement theory. And once you have that credibility lent by elected officials, especially by national public figures, there's an imprimatur that makes these things more acceptable. So in other words, ideologies, thought currents, viewpoints that in the 1980s certainly existed, but were much more isolated and much more, even one could argue, diffused across the country and had no opportunity to coalesce, or get any recognition, now unfortunately receive lots of top cover. Now, regardless of what President Trump's intentions were in August 2017, when following the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which a protester was in fact a person of the left, actually, was killed in a tragic automobile accident. I should say intentional use of an automobile as a weapon. That's the point I want to make. The president had said that there were fine people on both sides, regardless of what he intended. Doesn't matter. That was taken as an endorsement. Because we know empirically, this was all over their social media and websites. This was taken as an endorsement of their position. And then 3 years later, at the first presidential debate in September 2020, when then President Trump, when he was debating presidential candidate Joe Biden, had said about the Proud Boys, stand back and stand by. The Proud Boys reveled in that. They took that as an imprimatur, as a stamp of approval. So that has, I think, led to the volatile atmosphere that crystallized on January 6th.
That wasn't just a statement of approval. That would seem to be a veiled directive to them.
Again, whatever the president meant, or whatever President Trump intended by that message, I would say it almost doesn't matter because it was taken exactly as you described by the Proud Boys and by others. And that's why when he said something that could be interpreted in a variety of ways about January 6th, be there, be wild, there were people who took that as a green light to insurrection because we know there are individuals, they've now been convicted, 22 of them have been convicted of seditious conspiracy.
And after the fact saying that he loved them, go home in peace.
Right. But they were stockpiling weapons just outside of Washington, D.C. in motels in Roslyn, Virginia, for example, in Arlington County, just across the Potomac River, to act as a quick reaction squad. So we know that they took it quite literally. And that, I think, has become the problem.
I think Bruce is getting to a really good point about how actually clever some of this language is, because it's always veiled. It's always veiled. Will be wild, for example, can easily be dismissed as, oh, it was going to be wild. We're meeting here just a couple of days after President Trump said that if he loses the election, it'll be a bloodbath. And we've had this very public back and forth now in the media about, oh, he's talking about the markets. It's always veiled. It's always veiled. And that's the escape route for him, whether it's directed or whether it's not. Or to Bruce's really important point, whether it's deliberate or whether it's not, we know that the people on the violent far right are taking these words literally because they've done it before and they've said that they've done it before. So again, whether or not he is doing it deliberately, the people who are violent on behalf of this movement, they are taking it literally. So they are taking this to mean that there's a green light to a bloodbath if the election is lost. They are taking it literally that they're going to stand by after he says that in the presidential debate. There's always that almost separation from the actual violence, but the rhetoric along the path that we've been on for the past 8 years has always been accepting of that violent possibility, even if it's not directly channeled.
I did an interview some months ago with Ellie Honig. It's about how powerful people get away with it. And one way that a mafia boss gets away with, let's say, ordering an assassination is he orders it clandestinely, but then when he follows up, he asks, did you do the thing about the thing? There's always a very careful avoiding of any implication of responsibility and making sure that the lower ranking people get punished, not you.
Think of William Shakespeare and of English history when I think it was Henry VIII said, who will rid me of this man, about Sir Thomas More, right? He didn't actually give an order for Sir Thomas More to be killed, but just voicing the sentiments from a particular person in a leadership position can have both intended but equally so unintended consequences and can, especially in an era of social media, can unleash enormously powerful forces regardless of the intention, just simply based on the interpretation.
But it does seem like the intention counts for something, because if Donald Trump is actually intending for these things to happen, then of course the fear is that if he's reelected, he's going to be more brazen about invoking these things to happen.
We were, throughout the entire book, we're always very careful. We never talk about the far right or right wing. We talk about always violent far right extremism. And that really is the focus of the book. And people have discussed this in a wider dimension, which certainly exists, but it wasn't the focus of our book. We're talking about people planning and plotting actual terrorist attacks and incidents. And terrorism, by definition, is done by non-state actors. Governments terrorize people, certainly, but that's not terrorism. And of course, we're talking about terrorism and anti-government extremism, the reaction to government, not what governments might or might not do, or officials, once they're elected, might or might not implement.
I'll just double down quickly and say this is one of the great things about being counterterrorism scholars, is that we can shirk around those political questions. Bruce and I have our own political biases. They may or may not align with yours, Stuart, or the ones or the your listeners in Las Cruces, but so we can avoid getting bogged down in policy about what might happen in 2025 if President Trump is reelected. What I will say is we are very concerned, as are most people in our field, about election-related violence in 2024. And we've had this debate, Bruce and I, about, okay, from a raw counterterrorism standpoint, so not even getting involved in politics or policy, from a raw counterterrorism standpoint, is it better to have President Trump win election in 2024 or lose election in 2024? Because of course, if he wins, you have that top cover. You have that emboldening that we spoke about just a minute ago. If he loses, then you're more likely to have that January 6th kind of violence that rages against a government that is corrupt and stealing votes. Our conclusion from that conversation, Stuart, has been that both scenarios are bad.
So we're in trouble either way.
We're in trouble either way, I would say, unless politicians start taking this issue more seriously and start calling for peace, which does not seem to be something that's going to happen.
So what's the worst case scenario? I mean, people talk about civil war. I can't imagine a literal civil war, but there could be a very serious wave of violence in either of those scenarios, it seems to me. The level of arming of these groups is just really frightening.
The level of arming, certainly. The United States, far and away, has the largest number of legal firearms in the possession of its citizens. I'm not even talking about the illegal ones. There's 23 firearms per 100 Americans. Firstly, that's more than the next 25 countries. But secondly, the number two country in the world is one that's in the news a lot now, and we know is a very violent place, and that's Yemen. And there, it's only 53 firearms per 100 persons. So certainly you mix the proliferation of, or the availability of firearms in the United States with the power of social media, with an election where the two candidates are highly unpopular on both sides. One thing we haven't touched on, there's a very salient internecine or fratricidal element to this. It's not just red against blue, but it's red against red. My point earlier, that hangman's noose and scaffold in front of the U.S. Capitol on January 6th was for a sitting Republican vice president. We've already seen now threats against Republican officials from other Republicans. There's a campaign, for instance, in a Midwestern state where the candidate is calling for rhino hunting licenses to be issued. In other words, that there's a hunting season, or open season, I should say, on Republicans in name only. In other words, fellow Republicans who don't conform to a particular viewpoint. So we are at a very dangerous juncture in the United States where, you're right, it's probably as polarized as it's ever been, perhaps going back to the American Civil War. Perhaps one of the most positive aspects of the book is we examine some of the scholars that have argued the United States is potentially on the brink of a civil war, former National Security Council members, journalists as well. And we don't think it's a civil war per se. But as even our former boss at the Council on Foreign Relations, Dr. Richard Haass, has written, who was for two presidential administrations the special envoy for negotiations for peace in Northern Ireland, has said, Jacob and I also agree there could be a version of Northern Ireland's troubles in the United States as alienated, angry, disenfranchised individuals take to violence. And that's why at the start of the interview, I cited those repeated polls over the past 3 years by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland, where people on both sides basically say that in certain circumstances, violence could be justified against the federal government, which is just astonishing in a democracy.
Now, what's your take on the effect of Trump's rhetoric in terms of intimidation of potential rivals and also a kind of terrorizing of them to stop them from opposing him? It's just incredible to me that I think 100 Republican House members voted to invalidate the election or didn't vote to validate it on January 6th. It's hard to imagine that all of them are doing so out of conviction. I think there's a lot of fear, and fear, of course, of their electability, but I think also fear of retribution.
It's a reflection, I think, of a broken system, too, and of the frustrations of members of Congress that all politics is about compromise and about negotiation. That's what a democracy is also about as well. And
it used to be, anyway.
And that I think, is driving people out of office as well. And the fact that it has become more vitriolic, that for years now you have people campaigning, talking about targets for high-powered weapons, images of elected officials, things that would have been so acceptable and regarded as so outside the pale just a decade ago and more, are now appear with, I think, a remarkably depressing regularity. And that, yes, that has to have an influence of driving people out of office, which they already see as a vocation that attracts the opprobrium, not only of the other side, but even of those within their own party who don't agree with their positions or don't think that they're proper or appropriate.
You see this too, actually, in the poll workers. There was a very convincing, very frightening article written by two colleagues of Bruce and I, Seamus Hughes and Pete Simi. They called it The Slow Burn of Democracy. They basically argued that threats against poll workers, for example, are now so serious that they're not participating anymore. And so it's damaging our democracy and our electoral system at a much deeper level. And of course, that is part of the intention behind these threats. They're seeking to intimidate people into following the extremist's desire. And in this case, it's undermining the resilience and the strength of our entire system.
Just to end on a slightly more optimistic note, your book ends with a chapter on countermeasures. And we've talked about some of those already, about better regulation of social media. We talked a little bit about the psychological aspect of helping people and supporting people who are vulnerable, either because of PTSD or bullying or what have you, and including in the military and in the VA. And then you talk about the long term, teaching media literacy, starting in elementary school, to help people to tease out what's real and not real, or true and not true, or information versus disinformation. That's a much longer term process, and it would require a kind of a revamping of our educational system to put much more emphasis on that.
Yeah, most of what Bruce and I talk about, and also most of what we've spoken about in our field, deals with what you might call the supply side of extremist content. So trying to undermine the flood of disinformation and radicalizing material that we're facing in our world today. We also look at trying to address the demand side. So you have to ask the question, not just why do we have so much extremist material floating around, but why are people getting attracted to it? So that's that psychological element that we spoke about earlier. But we also talk about building resilience in a social media space to that kind of content through digital literacy, which includes a wide range of things from lateral reading. So this is that concept that basically if you read something on a website and your first reaction is, wow, that is unbelievable. I can't believe that's true. Odds are actually it's probably not true and you should go and find another source, ideally from a different political angle, that can verify that for you. That kind of stuff, also denoting expertise from opinion, all of that, I think, we hope can build resilience against this dangerous online content. And to be clear, that's not just a counter-extremism and counter-terrorism question, right? That also goes into disinformation from state actors, child sexual abuse material, body disorders, all kinds of online harms that we are having issues with in our society. We have to address both the demand and supply side and try to get to a place where we can have a healthier online ecosystem in which everybody can thrive.
So there's a lot of work to be done, but at least we have some idea of what work is needed to be done. So that's a good thing, at least. All right. I think we're just about out of time. So thank you so much for coming on to Delving In. Bruce Hoffman and Jacob Ware, co-authors of the recently published God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Stuart. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.